Part 2. The Transcendental Unity of Buddhism. The Dharma as Means. The unity of Buddhism consists in the fact that, through differences and divergences of doctrine innumerable, all schools of Buddhism aim at enlightenment, at reproducing the spiritual experience of the Buddha. The Dharma is therefore to be defined not so much in terms of this or that particular teaching, but rather as the sum total of the means whereby that experience may be attained. Hence, it can even be considered as being in principle and function, though not always in institutional form and specific intellectual content, as identical for all schools of Buddhism. The Pali scriptures represent the Buddha as emphasizing the instrumental character and relative value of the Dharma by means of a striking parable. Using the figure of a raft, brethren, I will teach you the Dharma, as something to leave behind, not to take with you. Do you listen to it? Apply your minds, I will speak. Even so, Lord, replied those brethren to the Exalted One. The Exalted One said, just as a man, brethren, who has started on a long journey, sees before him a great stretch of water, on this side full of doubts and fears, on the further side safe and free from fears, but there is no boat to cross in, no causeway for passing over from this side to the other side. Then he thinks thus, here is a great stretch of water, but there is no boat. How now, if I were to gather together grass, sticks, branches and leaves, bind them into a raft, and resting on that raft, paddle with hands and feet, and so come safe to the further shore? Then, brethren, that man gathers together sticks, and comes to the further shore. When he has crossed over, and come to the other side, he thinks thus, this raft has been great use to me. Resting on this raft and paddling with hands and feet, I have come to the further shore. Suppose now I were to set this raft on my head or lift it onto my shoulders and go my way. Now what think ye, brethren? Would that man in so doing have finished with that raft? Surely not, Lord. Doing what then, brethren, would that man have finished with that raft? Herein, brethren, that man who has crossed and gone to the further shore should think thus. This raft has been great use to me. Resting on it, I have crossed to the further shore. Suppose now I haul this raft onto the shore, or sink it in the water and go my way. By so doing, brethren, that man would have finished with that raft. Even so, brethren, using the figure of a raft, have I shown you the Dharma, as something to leave behind, not to take with you. Thus, brethren, understanding the figure of the raft, ye must leave righteous ways behind, not to speak of unrighteous ways. Majjhima Nikaya 1.134 Woodward's translation. That the teaching of the Enlightened One, far from being an end in itself, is only a means to an end, could hardly have been made clearer than this. One therefore would not have expected to find in certain Buddhist lands quite so many people busily engaged in carrying hither and thither upon their heads, on this shore, the very raft which, according to the Buddha, should be abandoned even after crossing over to the other shore. From the fact that the Dharma is, as the Buddha explicitly declares in the above-quoted passage, essentially that which conduces to the attainment of enlightenment, it necessarily follows that whatever conduces to the attainment of enlightenment is the Dharma. Another Pali text, cited in Chapter 1, may be repeated here, as it in fact represents the Buddha as drawing this very conclusion. Tamaha Pajapati, the Gotamid, the Master says, of whatsoever teachings, Gotamid, thou canst assure thyself thus, these doctrines conduce to passion, not to dispassion, to bondage, not to detachment, to increase of worldly gains, not to decrease of them, to covetousness, not to frugality, to discontent and not to content, to company, not to solitude, to sluggishness, not to energy, to delight in evil, not delight in good. Of such teachings, Gotamid, thou mayest with certainty affirm, this is not the Dharma, this is not the Vinaya, this is not the Master's message. But of whatsoever teachings thou canst assure thyself that they are the opposite of these things that I have told you, of such teachings thou mayest with certainty affirm, this is the Dharma, this is the Vinaya, this is the Master's message. Vinaya, Part 2, 10, Woodward's translation. The criterion of what is or what is not Buddhism is ultimately pragmatic. The question with which we concluded the last section is to be settled in the last resort, not by an appeal to logic, but by an appeal to spiritual life. This does not mean the setting up of a mere subjective feeling as our criterion. All those who are enlightened think that they are enlightened. Of course, not in an egoistic sense. But not all those who think they are enlightened are so in reality. Our spiritual experience must be in accordance with the spirit of the scriptures, and, what is more necessary still, its authenticity must be attested by one whose own enlightenment has been the object of similar attestation. Ultimately, this chain of pupillary succession is stapled onto the rock of the Buddha's own enlightenment, which is at once the support and the criterion of all succeeding attainments. Personal experience, or the realization of the individual Buddhist, will, if genuine, be in line with tradition, not indeed with, or not necessarily with, tradition in the merely bookish sense of the term, the authority of which the Buddha in fact repudiated, but rather with tradition in the sense of that unbroken succession of enlightened beings, upon whose existence the very life of the Dharma depends, and who, as torches that are lit from torches in a midnight marathon, alone illumine the darkness of the ages. These doctrines and methods, which do not have for their ultimate object enlightenment in the specifically Buddhist sense of the term, cannot be regarded as belonging to the Buddhist tradition. Conversely, those teachings are to be accepted as Buddhist, which, regardless of whether they were originally given out by the Master himself or by his enlightened disciples, both immediate and remote, are in practice found to be conducive to the realization of that very Sambodhi which he attained beneath the Bodhi tree at Gaya. The sole test of the genuineness of any school of Buddhism is its capacity to produce enlightened beings. Whether we are making a study of the institutional and personal aspect of the Dharma, as they are found in Sri Lanka, or as they are found in Tibet, or whether we are attempting to arrive at a true evaluation of the doctrines and methods of the Tantric schools or of the Jodo Shinshu, the orthodoxy and authenticity of this or that line of the Buddhist tradition is to be judged not in accordance with the alleged antiquity of its literature, nor by means of any other criterion of a merely external and historical nature, but solely in accordance with its present poverty or richness in respect of transcendental attainments. The Buddha Dharma, far from being confined to any one body of sacred texts, however ancient, or limited to any one set of traditional observances, dating from however early a period, in its full breadth, width, majesty and grandeur comprises, as Dr. Conze so well says, all those teachings which are linked to the original teachings by historical continuity, and which work out methods leading to the extinction of individuality by eliminating the belief in it. That schools which, for one reason or another, have lost faith in the possibility of attaining to realization of the transcendental order should venture to impugn the orthodoxy of schools whose faith is still green is therefore one of the greatest paradoxes of the whole course of Buddhist history. Such minor, and in any case comparatively modern, deviations from genuine orthodoxy apart, however, Buddhists of all schools, taking to heart the Buddha's admonition, have applied their minds to the understanding and practice of the teaching contained in the parable of the raft. So much so, indeed, that still more beautiful variants for it have been produced, among them the well-known Japanese simile of a finger that points out the moon. To look at the finger, representing the Dharma, instead of gazing at the moon, which stands for enlightenment, is no less foolish than carrying the raft about on one's own shoulders, and for no other reason. The doctrine, which both parable and simile are designed to illustrate, is in fact vitally important in Buddhism, being one of the factors responsible not only for the rich efflorescence of schools and teachings, which marked all spiritually active periods, but also for the extraordinary mutual tolerance by which their relations with one another were distinguished. Unlike the followers of certain non-Buddhist religious traditions, the spiritual heirs of the Enlightened One have, as a whole, clearly understood that not only the various observances comprising morality, not only the different practices which constitute meditation, but even the whole of those doctrinal formulations which are, not indeed wisdom itself, but the conceptual indications of wisdom, possess not an absolute but only a relative and instrumental value. This understanding is a direct consequence of the realization that, as we saw in Chapter 1, Section 8, Nirvana is ineffable, being equally beyond the reach of positive and negative predications, or even of no predication at all. Far from detracting from the value of right doctrine, or abrogating the need for it, much less still blurring in any way the distinction which at the intellectual level undoubtedly does exist between right doctrine and wrong, the way in which what may be termed the instrumental attitude insists upon the remoteness of the goal only serves to emphasize the necessity of having a raft and of it being constructed of the right materials. True doctrine is only relatively true, and false doctrine only relatively false, but the former must be upheld against the latter, because, as Nagarjuna says, the relative truth is the means to the realization of the absolute truth. Right doctrine indicates reality, though it is powerless to describe it, but wrong doctrine can neither indicate it nor describe it. All Buddhist schools, whether of the Mahayana or the Hinayana, were concerned not with the theoretical determination of truth as an end in itself, but with its practical realization in life. What divided them, therefore, was not differences of opinion over what was true and what untrue, in the scientific descriptive sense of that term, for all agreed that truth, being indescribable, was a matter for personal experience, but differences regarding which doctrines, as well as which ethical observances and which meditational techniques, could in practice function as the means for the attainment of enlightenment. Whether they were aware of what was happening or not, it was due to the conjunction of their understanding of the relativity of the Dharma with a compassionate desire to share the experience of enlightenment with as many sentient beings as possible, that led to the springing up within the rapidly widening field of Buddhism of those rich crops of methods leading to the extinction of individuality by eliminating the belief in it, in which every school, but especially the schools of the Mahayana, were so astonishingly fertile. As might have been anticipated by anyone familiar with the 40 classical supports of concentration enumerated and to some extent described in section 17 of the preceding chapter, it was within the sphere of meditation that such productivity was most marked. As we then observed, the supports of concentration are potentially infinite. Consequently, as the teachers of meditation were not slow in realizing, the possibilities of adding to the number of traditionally sanctioned aids to mental one-pointedness are without limit. The sadhana class of literature is an example. A sadhana is a text describing the shape, colour, insignia, attributes, etc. of a Buddha, a bodhisattva, a guardian deity, or of a member of one of the various other classes of divine beings, for the purpose of visualizing them in meditation. Directions of a general nature, as well as doctrinal teachings, are often given. In Tibetan alone, both inside and outside the 300 and odd volumes of the sacred canon, there must be several thousand of these texts, some indigenous. Probably even the most learned Geshe could not say exactly how many there are. All are applications in accordance with the diverse needs of devotees of many different temperaments and character types of one unchanging central principle, the principle that concentration, without which wisdom cannot be attained, consists in the undistracted, wholesome fixation of the mind on a single object. Developments within the sphere of morality were much less spectacular. Again, as might have been anticipated, they pertained more to details of casuistry than to ethical principles. The Theravadins, for instance, discovered that it would be wrong for a monk to pull his mother out of a pit by the hand, should she be so unfortunate as to fall into one, as that would be a violation of the monastic obligation to refrain from physical contact with women. Certain Mahayanists, on the other hand, started teaching that monks might possess wealth and property, even gold, silver, and silken clothes, as such possessions would allow them to be more useful to others and to help others. Generally speaking, the Hinayanists were interested more in the personal, the Mahayanists more in the social side of ethics. The contrast is, however, far from being absolute, for the Mahayana conception of morality was, on the whole, remarkably balanced and harmonious, being based on a well-nigh perfect correspondence between the self-regarding and other-regarding aspects of the moral life. Doctrinal developments, developments within the sphere of wisdom, while naturally much less numerous than those in meditation, were considerably in excess of what took place within the domain of morality. Statistics are, however, not the best instrument for gauging the influence or plumbing the depths and significance of teachings pertaining to the transcendental order. The quite extensive doctrinal developments which occurred not only in India, but also in Japan, and to some extent in China too, took place partly by way of an attempt to push to their ultimate logical conclusion the teachings attributed to the Buddha, many of which were suggestive rather than exhaustive in nature, partly because of the need for building up for the doctrine a systematic rational basis from which the tenets of Buddhism could be defended and the theories of non-Buddhist schools attacked. The fact that the two forks of a road have branched off at the same spot does not prevent them, after they have proceeded almost parallel with each other for a mile or two, from ultimately diverging in opposite directions. Similarly, given the same doctrine, it is possible for different persons to arrive in the end at conclusions which to the intellect appear contradictory. Shin and Zen, the two principal schools of present-day Japanese Buddhism, have, with the same Indo-Chinese Mahayana tradition as their foundation, succeeded in erecting thereon doctrinal superstructures between which there is no more resemblance than between a classical frieze and a Baroque altar. The former, as we have already noted, believes that emancipation consists in a wholehearted surrender to the other power, in an unconditional faith in and dependence on the saving grace of Amitabha, while the latter maintains that it can be won only by means of a complete reliance on self-power, on the unaided and unsupported efforts of the individual devotee. Contradictions of this kind should not dismay us. Realities of the transcendental order are no more susceptible of fully adequate intellectual formulation as doctrine than a three-dimensional body can, without distortion, be represented on a two-dimensional surface. Do not Australia and South America look, in Mercator's projection of the globe, as though they were situated at opposite ends of the earth? A flatlander, ignorant of the existence of a third dimension, would probably conclude that the nearer one went to the Antarctic, the further he would be going from South America. In one sense, indeed, his conclusion would be true, though it would not be the whole truth, for the addition of a third dimension does not contradict the other two so much has deepened their significance. It is quite possible that doctrines which, like the other power teaching of Shen and the self-power teaching of Zen, on the intellectual plane are in complete mutual opposition, should both be the means of attaining to that suprarational, purely transcendental experience known as enlightenment. Like all other Buddhist traditions, both schools do in fact propose enlightenment, in the sense of supreme Buddhahood, as the final goal of the religious life, a circumstance which should be in itself sufficiently arresting to make us pause and reflect before jumping from premises merely intellectual to sweeping conclusions on the subject of which schools are to be regarded as genuinely Buddhist and which are not. The Dharma is essentially the means to enlightenment, and, intellectual difficulties notwithstanding, schools which have transmitted the experience of enlightenment must be assumed to have transmitted the Dharma too. We should have the courage not of our intellectual convictions, but of our transcendental realizations. The doctrinal differences existing between the different schools of Buddhism ought to delight rather than dismay us, for we are thereby stung into keener awareness of the limitations of the intellect, startled into livelier recognition of the purely instrumental nature of the Dharma, and at last awakened into a clearer comprehension of the great truth that, as Buddha himself said repeatedly, Nirvana is an atakavatra, beyond the reach of reasoning. Accordingly, we find the Prajnaparamita literature rejecting formal logic and revelling in a mystifying and bewildering logic of contradictions, which, to a mind suckled at the breast of Dame Syllogism and nicely brought up on Barbara, Celerent and Dari, will seem like the nightmare ravings of a lunatic logician. The law of identity states that A is A, the law of contradiction that A cannot be both B and not B, and the law of excluded middle that a thing must be either be or not be. But the Prajnaparamita, the texts relating to perfect wisdom, declare, beings, beings, O Subhuti, as no beings have they been taught by the Tathagata. Therefore they are called beings. Symbolically, A is B because it is not B. In the dimension of emptiness, wherein the Bodhisattva courses with a coursing that is a non-coursing, and wherein he cognizes that truth is by means of a cognition that is a non-cognition, contradictory terms are identical. So long as the mind oscillates between contradictory statements, trying to determine which of them is true and which false, the aspirant remains immured within the mundane. But no sooner does he embark upon a bold identification of opposites than, bypassing the intellect, he disappears from the phenomenal plane and reappears in the transcendental, in the domain and dimension of emptiness. On the same principle, on which it is possible for both the Shin and Zen teachings to be genuine Buddhism, it should be possible for an individual Buddhist to be simultaneously a follower of both schools, to rely on the other power at the very moment that it relies on the self-power. Not indeed by way of some painfully laborious process of intellectual syncretism, but by means of an experience transcending the plane of dualistic thought construction. Out of its profound realization of this truth, Zen Buddhism teaches that one should rise above the limitations of the intellect by means of a deliberate cultivation of contradictory attitudes. The unremitting struggle to resolve at the intellectual level a contradiction which at that level cannot possibly be resolved, produces a certain psychological tension which, being stepped up by degrees, finally results in a shattering explosion. We find that the walls are all down, and we have only to step over the debris in order to be able to move about freely in the realm of the transcendental. One of the Zen sub-schools goes so far as to regard meditation on problems or situations embodying an insoluble contradiction as the main spiritual exercise. Of these problems, technically known as koan, there are said to be several thousands, further evidence of the astonishing richness of Buddhism in the field of meditation. Dr. Suzuki's writings have been the means of familiarising English-knowing students not only with this type of support for the development of insight, but also with many other Zen practices, all of which have, as the reader now need hardly be reminded, the attainment of enlightenment as their ultimate objective. The koan of the goose in the bottle is a well-known example. A goose confined in a bottle when it was quite young has grown so big that it is now impossible for it to squeeze through the neck. How is it to be set at liberty without breaking the glass? The symbolical nature of the koan will be apparent even to the rational mind, though we should be going far astray indeed if we thought that the ultimate meaning of the symbolism was therefore within the reach of reason. Other examples are still more elusive. What is the sound made by the clapping of one hand? Such are the seemingly nonsensical problems upon which the Zen disciple meditates. Readers in search of fuller information on the subject are referred to the works of Dr. Suzuki, who writes with equal charm and brilliance and at equal length on the ineffability of Zen and on the complete uselessness of attempting either to speak or to write about that ineffability. Once again, it is a case of a finger pointing to the moon. Unless he has succeeded in grasping the principle which we have endeavoured to set forth in the present section, the principle of the transcendental unity of all schools of Buddhism, the reader will feel only bewilderment when, in section 3, he is at last confronted by the greatest of all koans, the difference amounting at times to unmitigated contradiction between the Hinayana and the Mahayana.